Hello everyone, this is Dr. Miles, and this video is when to run the GI map test or another comprehensive stool analysis. So in order to make this the most practical that we possibly can, we're focusing on one stool test, the GI map, but please know that there are other good stool tests in any comprehensive stool analysis. Is usually good and helpful, some a little better than others, and the GI map happens to be one that is a favorite of ours and we've run a lot of, and a lot of our colleagues have good experience with it. But do know that the BiomeFX is a good option, GIFX by Genova is a good option, Doctor's Data has a good option, and Parasitology Center has a good option. So there are a number of good options for stool tests out there. But when do we run a stool test? So the first, before I go into any of the symptoms, any of the things that you would think about running it with, the first thing I want to say is if someone's traveled internationally and they got, especially if they got sick while they were overseas, but even if they didn't get sick while they were overseas, it's really, really helpful to do a time, try and get a time frame for when they started to feel unwell. And if they traveled internationally within a few months of starting to feel unwell, then I would absolutely highly prioritize a stool test. If a person has digestive issues as their chief complaint, then I would prioritize a stool test even if they've never traveled internationally. If they have a lot of these symptoms, that would be another case to prioritize a stool test. And in general, if people can afford it, a stool test is a worthwhile investment for most people to do on a once a year or every other year basis to check and see whether there's any digestive issues that have cropped up. So some of the symptoms would be heartburn, acid reflux, sour regurgitation, history of proton pump inhibitor use, immune issues or chronic infections, and obviously immune issues can be for a variety of reasons. Chronic infections can happen with or without gut issues. But when there's one chronic infection, we often see gut infections present too. So when there are immune issues, and especially if the immune system is a little bit deficient, then we also see an increased incidence of digestive infections. Mood issues like depression or anxiety, there's a big link between certain gut bacteria and mood issues in the brain and neurotransmitters in the brain. So there can be a dysbiosis, and that dysbiosis can be identified on a stool test, and or there can be infections. I had a patient who she had a chief symptom of anxiety, and we did a stool test, found Blastocystis hominis, which is a protozoal parasite, treated it, and her anxiety dramatically improved. So that can happen with gut infections and anxiety. Joint pain or other myalgia, muscle pain. There's a big link between SIBO and joint pain, but also other gut infections can link to joint pain and certain autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid arthritis that can affect the joints. Headaches or migraines can also commonly be linked with gut dysfunction. Chemical sensitivities can be linked with gut issues. Gas, of course, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, some of the obvious ones, irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease, like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. Weight changes, especially if sudden or unexpected or unexplained by diet or lifestyle changes, if someone just changes weight or even blood sugar, for that matter, there can be microbiome changes that can happen. We have studies of mice that are germ-free mice that are twins, identical twins, and one gets the microbiome transplant from an obese mouse and becomes obese. So we know sudden weight changes can relate to, and those mice were on the same diet, you know, living essentially the same lifestyle. So it was a microbiome change that instigated that weight gain in that mouse, even though the genetically identical twin did not gain weight. So not genetics. Fatigue, definitely something to investigate. All sorts of different things can have many, many different causes, but the gut is one. Brain fog or signs of cognitive decline. There's a gut-brain connection, and so it's helpful to, if there are issues with focus, concentration, ability to recall words, or even just think clearly, or if there are memory issues, these can be a sign that gut would be one place to check. Autoimmune disease, because there's a link with intestinal permeability with many autoimmune diseases, in addition to genetics and triggers that are environmental triggers, there's also often intestinal permeability. And then what goes behind intestinal permeability is either small intestine bacterial overgrowth or fungal overgrowth or a dysbiosis of some sort that could be identified on a stool test, or a parasite infection or a bacteria like H. pylori. So these kinds of things, some of which can be identified on stool testing. Skin conditions, especially rosacea. Rosacea has a huge link to H. pylori, which we can see on stool tests, and also SIBO. So if there's rosacea present, then we definitely want to do a stool test. Halitosis, bad breath. So that can be linked with low stomach acid, which can be linked with H. pylori. Gastritis or inflammation in the stomach and intestines can be linked with H. pylori and other things found on stool tests. Stomach cancer, hormone dysregulation. If there's hormone dysregulation, of course, a lot of practitioners go straight to hormone replacement therapy. But we find that if you address the gut first, many hormone dysregulations will improve dramatically and sometimes resolve completely. Anxiety or depression. So we already talked about anxiety, but depression, or really anything in the spectrum of mood disorders, the gut may be a piece of it. So those are some of the main symptoms. Then we have connections with other systems. So you can think on a systems level, not just a symptoms level. If we think about the GI tract and the hormonal system and a connection between those systems. Now, there are multiple mechanisms for connection between systems. I'm just going to give one here for the hormonal system. So estrogen can get broken down through a process of glucuronidation in the liver, and that puts a glucuronide bond on those little pieces. And then we have what's called beta-glucuronidase in the gut, which is an enzyme that gets upregulated by infections in the gut. So when there's an infection and there's a high amount of beta-glucuronidase breaks the glucuronide bonds. And so if estrogen was broken apart through glucuronidation, had these glucuronide bonds that are kind of like the liver's way of tagging and saying, that's for trash, that's to go away, that's to get out with the stool. The beta-glucuronidase enzyme from a gut infection upregulation can take some of those bonds off, and then estrogens can reform and or recirculate. And this can challenge the body's ability to regulate estrogen and then can contribute to issues with estrogen progesterone ratios and can contribute to hormonal imbalance. GI tract, brain, and neurotransmitters. So although a lot of people think about the neurotransmitter serotonin as being a happiness neurotransmitter made in the brain, and that if someone's having depression, they might get a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drug, an SSRI, to help that serotonin stay around for a longer period of time. There's also serotonin that's local to the gut, 90%, in fact, of serotonin is made in the gut, and there's a motility relationship with serotonin. And that's why 5-HT4 medications are sometimes used for motility issues. And sometimes 5-HTP as a supplement is used for motility issues as a precursor for serotonin. And we see that in one study, the 5-HTP restored mouse gut motility that had been dysfunctional. So we know serotonin plays a role in the gut, especially in the ability of the gut to properly flush fiber and debris out of the small intestine into the large intestine. And there can be dysbiosis or bacterial overgrowth as a result of motility disorders. Regulating weight and eating behaviors, there are these signals that go from the gut to the brain, from the stomach to the brain, and from the brain to the gut. And the eating behaviors and weight have a lot to do with the microbiome and those signals from the microbiome, which is part of why I mentioned we had those genetically identical mice, one of whom got bacteria from an obese mouse and became obese. So the microbiome and the bacteria in the gut can really play a role in regulating weight and eating behaviors. 50% of dopamine is also made in the gut. The function's really not so understood there. So we don't know exactly what that dopamine's doing, but it may play a role in the gut, and hopefully we'll get some more research at some point about that. There was a mouse study that was really telling that took a probiotic and gave this probiotic, it was a lactobacillus, I believe rhamnosus, in this study. And they gave half of the mice some lactobacillus rhamnosus in their feed, and the other half a germ-free broth that had no probiotics in it, sterile broth. So the sterile broth group was subjected to a stress test, well, both groups were, and the stress test was a bowl of water, and the mice were put in the bowl of water, and they were trying to escape because they don't like water, and they were trying to escape, but they couldn't because the bowl was slippery. So it really was a futile attempt. And the group that had the sterile broth was put in there and timed. And first minute trying to escape swimming around, second minute trying to escape swimming around. And then they pretty much gave up. And they just floated there. They didn't drown, but they just floated there and didn't really try to escape anymore. The other group, the other half that had gotten the lactobacillus rhamnosus probiotic, they swam for the 1 minute, swam for the 2 minute, and they kept swimming for a third minute, kept swimming for a fourth minute. They swam a full 2 minutes longer than the group that had the sterile broth, and they would have kept swimming if they didn't stop the experiment at that point. And then they thought, well, okay, maybe it's something about this probiotic in the gut is making them more resilient. So they had measured some things like corticosterone, which for mice is a lot like cortisol is in humans. And so the cortisol response for these mice, the corticosterone, increased significantly in both groups. But what was interesting is that GABA, a neurotransmitter that's a very relaxing, calming neurotransmitter, GABA increased dramatically in the group with the lactobacillus rhamnosus. It's sort of like the corticosterone increased, they were stressed out, and then GABA increased and calmed their nervous system, and then corticosterone increased, and then GABA, and corticosterone and GABA, like their stress response was modulated on the fly so they could keep going, keep problem solving, keep seeing if they could figure a way out. Whereas the other group, the corticosterone rose, without the GABA they burned out and gave up. So that was a resilience, a stress resilience that was found from giving a probiotic. And they took it a step further. They said, well, what if we cut the vagal nerve of these mice that had the increased by 2 minute stress response that had gotten the probiotic? So they cut the vagal nerve and they subjected them back to the same stress test, and they immediately reverted back to the same time as the group that had not gotten the probiotic. And what they determined by that is it must be a signal from the gut through the vagal nerve to the brain, telling the brain to make that GABA. And so this very fascinating study showed that certain gut bacteria may be able to stimulate signals along the vagal nerve to the brain to tell the brain to make certain neurotransmitters. So the American Psychological Association's come out and started talking about how a majority of the neurotransmitters are stimulated through communication with the gut now. And so the brain and neurotransmitters have a strong relationship with the gut. So if you see people who have brain issues and neurotransmitter issues, you may want to look at the gut. GI tract and detoxification. So the cytochrome P450 system has a direct channel from the gut via the portal vein. So when bacteria and debris make their way in food and people eat that food, and then the stomach acid will help to kill off some of that, but some may still make its way through, or some toxins like xenoestrogens, for example, may make their way through and then get absorbed into the bloodstream via the portal vein. They're going to go to the liver. And there are some cytochromes, some enzymes that will break down, like cytochrome 3A4 will break down a lot of the chemicals or xenoestrogens, for example, that might have gotten exposed through consumption, and if some chemicals had been on food or some xenoestrogenic compounds on food, then that can go through the liver and be detoxified. So that's one way that the liver and detoxification and whatever compounds aren't able to be taken care of through the body up until the point of entering the gut, some of those compounds, if they make their way into the bloodstream via the portal vein, will go to the liver, and then the liver will have a detoxification process there. So if there's excessive liver issues and or detoxification issues, we also want to look at the gut as playing a role. And we want to look at, do we have adequate function from things like our stomach acid and our digestive enzymes to break things down properly and minimize the number of things that are getting to the liver? And are we experiencing intestinal permeability, where bigger things or things that aren't intended to go into the bloodstream are getting there? Then the GI tract and the immune system. We have about 70 to 80% of immune cells are in the gut. We have M cells, we have enterocytes, we have Peyer's patches, lymphocytes, we have mucus that has secretory IgA. So there's lots of immune function happening in the gut. The gut's kind of that barrier. We're protecting ourselves from the outside world, and we have our skin on the outside, but then when we're consuming food, we're trying to get nutrients in, but we don't want to get problem pathogens in. So there's a lot of immune activity happening along the gut because that's that border, that entry into our body. And that's a border, unlike the skin, where we're not trying to let too much through the skin. We want to let lots and lots of nutrients through the gut. So we have to have robust immune activity there. So obviously, when there are immune issues, we need to look to it's either going to create the bigger chance for more issues to happen in the gut, or it's going to potentially contribute to the gut function might contribute to, if that's not going well, then that might contribute to immune issues elsewhere in the body. The GI tract and skin. There's a big connection between digestion and skin, gut issues and skin issues. We know the research on rosacea is strong. There's research on autoimmune issues like psoriasis that's quite strong with inflammatory bowel disease and celiac. So there's a big relationship between GI issues and the skin. So that is when to test for doing one of these stool analyses like the GI map. If there's any of these connected systems, any of those symptoms, that it would be a consideration. Obviously, there's always a budgetary consideration. Stool testing that's comprehensive is not inexpensive, especially if it does not go through insurance. And a lot of these tests can go through insurance, but insurance may or may not pay for them, and sometimes they're considered specialty testing. So depending on the person and their insurance and their budget and how your clinic works, you may prioritize stool testing more or less of the time. But please do know that it can be a very significant part of a person's symptom picture, and I very seldom find a patient who doesn't have either an issue that we find on a stool test or an issue that we find in a SIBO breath test. Now, treatment for SIBO breath test issues, for SIBO and for issues that we find on these stool tests, much of the treatment, there's a lot of overlap. So you can often get away practically with doing one of the two tests if you really feel that a person's budget can only afford one of the two and you need to prioritize other things, especially if you pick the one that finds something, then the treatment may take care of, like if, for example, you find H. pylori, the treatment for that may take care of SIBO. If you find SIBO, the treatment for that may take care of a parasite infection. Not always, not necessarily, so it's better if we can have more testing, but if we can't, then having one of the two gut tests in almost every case of a new client can be pretty helpful. And you can treat proactively without a test, if especially you're seeing quite a few symptoms that are related to SIBO, for example, or one of the infections that we'll talk about later in this module. You can proactively treat without a test. And some of those treatments that we're going to give you are going to be things that are pretty safe for someone, even if they don't have an issue. But we don't want to treat unnecessarily, and we are using antimicrobials in a lot of these treatments. So we also don't want to disturb a microbiome that's functioning quite well. So do keep that in mind and be sure that there is an issue if you are going to treat proactively. And if there are enough symptoms, you can be pretty sure that there is an issue. So your options are treat proactively, do either the SIBO or a stool test, or do both SIBO and a stool test, or in some cases, you might even want to do two different stool tests by two different companies, especially if someone has really severe digestive issues that have been going on for a long time. That's a wrap for this lesson. Thank you so much for watching, and have a healthy and happy day.